We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining me today is Professor Steve Hanke. He's a professor of applied economics at Johns Hopkins. How are you today, Dr. Hanke?
I'm doing pretty well, Tom.
I appreciate you taking the time to join me today. And you said that we can be a little bit more informal in our discussion today, so I'll get to call you Steve. But you were gracious enough to have sent me some notes for today's interview. And one of the things that really struck me about you is the amount of experience that you have had from a young age, really working with commodities. So do you think that these formative experiences gave you a different perspective than most about the importance of commodities?
Well, yes. To go back quite a few years, Tom, when I was around 10 years of age, I started helping my grandfather hedge eggs. At that time, I grew up in Iowa, and one of my grandfathers had a pretty large egg candling operation. Now, what that means, that he was collecting eggs, of course, from all the neighboring farms and so forth, and bringing them into a plant in which they would grade the eggs, sort the eggs, clean them, box them, and then put them into storage until they basically got a semi-load full or several semi-loads full, and then they would ship these back to either New York or Boston. But in that interval of time, you've got the eggs in storage, and the prices could be going all over the place. So What do you do? You make a decision. Do I want to take the price risk, or do I want to hedge the eggs? And in those days, there was a contract on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, an egg contract. And if you didn't want to take the price risk, you'd sell them forward on the futures market, and that would be the end of it. So I learned how to do this when I was around 10, and then by the time I was 14, I actually opened my own account and was trading. At that time, the first trades I made were in soybeans. Mm-hmm. So then one thing led to another. And then later on in 1985, actually, I joined the Friedberg Mercantile Group in Toronto as a chief economist. I was a professor at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, of course, but also was assumed this other responsibility with Dr. Albert Friedberg up in Toronto. And they're a large commission merchant trading at that time, as now, they're trading everything under the sun. But oil was a big thing in 1985, and we'd modeled the thing out and determined that OPEC was going to collapse, and we were the first ones, to, I think, in the world to call a price move down below $10 a barrel. So we had very big short positions on everything under the sun, including, by the way, the Saudi rial and the Kuwaiti dinar, the currencies. We shorted those. And of course, OPEC did collapse. Oil did go below $10 a barrel, and that worked out very well. But in the meantime, there was a lot of trading going on of foreign exchange, equities, bonds, commodities of all types, and so that's the kind of at 30,000 feet going through things very fast, but the oil trade, by the way, we were trading very large positions. After the fact, we figured out that the gas oil contract in London, we had probably about 70% of the short interest in the London market. So it was quite something, actually. But there were other things going on. The collapse of the ruble in 1998 called that. And, mm-hmm. This thing and that thing, lots of trades, lot, Well, the good ones we can talk about. The bad ones, we'll just forget that, Tom.
We'll maybe learn from them, right?
Yeah. Oh, it's always a learning experience. That's the name of the game. Mm-hmm.
And of course, one of the other, let's say, maybe highlights of your career was that you started teaching at the Colorado School of Mines in 1966. So I wanted to ask you how you've seen, let's say, the attitude, you know, over your career, the attitude towards gold change over that time.
Remember when that was 1966. Well, 1971 came along. You know what happened then? The gold window got shut in the United States, and all semblance of gold was really removed from the U.S. dollar. In the U.S. dollar financial system. So there was a tremendous amount of interest that occurred in 1971, that period in 71, 2, 3, and so forth. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of a high point, a lot of excitement. And then things, I would say, have been kind of steady as you go since then. That was a big event. I mean, that was huge. And of course, the price increase was huge too. but at any rate, there's always a steady interest in gold, simply because, as Bob Mundell, a Nobel laureate in economics, a Canadian, by the way, indicated, he was the father of the euro, one of the father of so-called supply-side economics, a Nobel laureate, as I say, a good friend of mine. And Mundell wrote someplace, I can't remember exactly where, perhaps it was in his Nobel acceptance speech, that gold would always be one way or another part of the international financial system. And so it is important. And it's not going away. And I think Mundell's general conclusion and observations are correct, that it always has been and probably always will be part of the international financial system in some way.
So another very interesting fact about you is that you've predicted and or stopped 23 different currency hyperinflations, more than any other economist. So I'd like to kind of dig in on maybe some of these definitions and get your take on exactly what you mean by hyperinflation.
Okay, the custom and practice in the economics profession has come out of work that Professor Kagan did in one famous article in 1956, in which Kagan defined hyperinflation as an inflation rate of 50% per month or more. And so that's been adopted by the profession, and that's the way it's used. Now, if you look at the kind of lay press and so forth, they fling the hyperinflation around all the time. I mean, a lot of people are writing, we have hyperinflation in the United States right now, or we're going to have, and the inflation rate's 8.5% per annum, not per month even. So that's been the definition, and I've been able to develop using basically a very old standard orthodox model of purchasing power parity, so I can use very high frequency data every hour if I wanted to, but I can do it every day to measure the inflation rate in a country with elevated inflation. And so I've modified the definition a little bit now, since we can measure more accurately, 50% per month for 30 consecutive days. 50% per month for 30 consecutive days. Now, if you had, Tom, that 50% per month number, every month for a year, you'd end up, I can't remember the precise number right now, but it's more or less about 12,500% per year would be the inflation rate. So that's the kind of magnitude you're talking about. And we've had 62 hyperinflations in history. They aren't that common, but they occur, and they usually occur, well, they almost always occur when the fiscal deficits become very large and the governments involved can't finance those deficits by either increasing taxes or going to the bond market, either a domestic bond market or an international bond market. And so they go to the central bank and they basically say, we've got some great bonds we want to sell you. And the central bank, of course, has, central bank governor usually has a gun at his head or her head, and they buy the bonds. Now, how do they do that? Well, they print so-called print money. I mean, they credit the government's account. I mean, they don't actually print money per se, but they run the proverbial printing press, and that gets you hyperinflation. So the recent ones, one that I measured and observed was in Yugoslavia in January of 1994. They had a hyperinflation of 313 million% per month. 313 million% per month. So, and I know Yugoslavia well, because I, in 1990 until the Civil War started in June of 1991, I was the chief economic advisor in Yugoslavia. So I know the system and know how it worked, knew how to measure the hyperinflation and did so. And what was happening at the time, you had a civil war going on. And the government in Belgrade was spending a lot of money, but they didn't have the capacity to raise taxes. They were shut off from the international bond market. The local banks were already up to their eyeballs in Yugoslav debt and couldn't take on any more. So they went to the central bank and the classic printing press operation occurred, and we're talking about a lot of government finance. In that case, over 95% of all the government expenditures were being financed by the central bank that way. So they had essentially everything was a deficit, and they were just going to the central bank. So you get it, and that was a civil war, and you get it after wars or during wars. And you also had a number of hyperinflations after the Soviet Union collapsed, because those countries that had the former Soviet states and the Warsaw Bloc states, the old communist countries associated with the Soviet Union, they essentially didn't have taxes. So they had no tax administration, no tax setup. So they kept spending money. In many cases, they were just running up arrears. They weren't paying people. They were running up arrears, but they were spending a lot of money. They didn't have any taxes. They had no bond markets that were developed. They couldn't get into the international bond market, so they went to the central banks. So you had many of these things happened after the fall of in the 90s. And after World War II, you have some. And then you have some countries in South America, for example, that have had hyperinflations it's kind of a more genetic. It's kind of a Latino thing, shall we say. They have had hyperinflations in Latin America where there have been no wars and the system hadn't collapsed or something like that. But so that's it, 62 of them. And all of them I measured and looked at them in some detail. Mm-hmm. Right now, we have none. The last big one that we had was Venezuela, and that ended some months ago. They still have very high rates of inflation, but not hyperinflation.
So as you're talking about Yugoslavia not having access to these international bond markets and these constraints that you've mentioned, is it possible that, considering that the rest of the world uses US dollars, that that somehow protects the US a little bit more from this type of inflationary scenario and also exports that inflation throughout the world as well?
Well, that's a good point, Tom, because once you get into hyperinflation, of course, there's what they call currency substitution takes place. Everybody wants to get rid of the hyperinflating currency like a hot potato. And what do? The preference usually is the U.S. dollar. Mm-hmm. So you have actually of U.S. dollar notes that circulate, More or less around 65-70% of all the dollars circulating, the notes are not in the United States or overseas. Mm-hmm. And that's why, because people want the greenback and they want it, particularly when inflation starts getting high. You don't have to have hyperinflation to see this kind of currency substitution, but you get it complete where you get hyperinflation. Now, if you look at Zimbabwe, for example, Zimbabwe had a couple of hyperinflations actually recently. The big one, though, the second highest hyperinflation in the world was in November. It peaked in November of 2008 in Zimbabwe. And what happened, the inflation rate there was doubling almost every 24 hours. So it was a tremendous hyperinflation. And people finally just spontaneously dollarized the whole economy. They went on strike. They wouldn't use the Zim dollar at all. And when that happened, the currency substitution was 100%. I mean, that was an extreme case. And it was fairly recent, 2008. And you could see exactly what was happening, just what you were describing, as everything went into U.S. dollars, and the local currency was not used for anything. They refused to use it.
So in another piece entitled Three Fiscal Rules for Bulgaria, you wrote that inflation is always and everywhere caused by one and only one thing, the creation of excess money. So, of course, over the past 2 years, we've seen the U.S. money supply expand by somewhere around 40%. Is this a perfect case to look at when considering this cause and effect relationship?
Yes. Now, there are a lot of cases, but that's an interesting one because we're living in it. So it's we're not studying the history of money or history of inflations, and as a student would be in a textbook, we're living in it. And what has happened since COVID broke out in February of 2020, the money supply has increased in the United States, broadly measured by the money supply measure M2, which is the broadest measure that the Fed measures. It's gone up, as you say, about 41%. So I like to use a bathtub, a monetary bathtub, as John Greenwood, who's one of my colleagues at Johns Hopkins, that just recently retired as a chief economist at Invesco in London. But John and I have worked a lot on this. And the monetary bathtub, you have In the spigot, you've got this 41% coming into the tub, and the money goes into the tub, and then what happens to it? Well, there are two things that happen to it by way of drains. One is to accommodate real economic activity that takes some of the money, so that drains some away. Mm-hmm. And then there's another drain, and that's the increased demand for money, because as the economy grows and people have more income, they demand more money in their portfolios, more cash in their checking accounts and money market accounts, things like that. So that drains some. And that leaves what in the tub? if anything. And now the drains have taken about 25% of the 41% away. So you're left with a residual in the tub, Tom, of about a 30% increase since February of 2020. Now where does that go? Well, that goes into what Greenwood and I call the inflation overflow valve. It goes out the inflation overflow valve, and that's how you get inflation. That's excess money. It was never drained away to accommodate real economic activity. It never drained away to accommodate increases in the demand for money, but it's there, and it eventually comes out with a lag of about 12 to 24 months into inflation, and of course that's what we have now. I mentioned before we have a 8.5% inflation in the United States. In July of last year, Greenwood and I wrote an article in the Wall Street Journal in which we indicated that by the end of 2021, just a few months ago, that the inflation would be at least 6% and maybe as high as 9%. So we were right on, and we were right on because we were using the the quantity theory of money or monetarism to explain inflation. And inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon, excess money being created. And when we say excess, to get things about right in the United States and have the Fed, the central bank, hit its inflation target of 2%, they should be growing the money supply at around 5 to 6% per year. Well, look at this period of time since COVID. The rate of growth, the annual rate, was about 18% on average. Mm-hmm. It was a higher than that in your early months, and then it's come down. So we've had monetary growth that was, on average about three times higher than it should have been to hit the inflation target. And even today, the rate of growth in the money supply is measured by M2. It's still chugging away. It's come down a little bit, but we're at right now precisely 9.85%. Even right now, 9.85%. Mm-hmm. So if they would bring that down to 5 or 6% soon, inflation isn't going to stop because you've got that excess in the tub still coming out. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have an inflation problem no matter what they do. Even if they can get the quantity of money growing at an appropriate rate of 5 or 6%, something like that, even if they get it down to that, we're still going to have this overflow valve leaking out excess money into the system until certainly the end of 2023. Mm-hmm. So that's part of, we were talking about commodities, and that's part of the commodity story is inflation. When you do have inflation, you not only get currency substitution, trying to get into, if you have high inflation in Argentina, you want to get into the greenback or one of these other, Sudan or wherever the country happens to be. But if you look at commodities are priced in dollars. Most commodities are. So if you have inflation occurring, the translation of that inflation goes into the commodity prices and commodity markets. So this is background into the commodity markets. Then we have commodity markets. The second thing is the fact that we have prices that have been going up and coming off extremely low levels. And now accelerating, We've got extremely low inventories, and we know that because if the spot price of a commodity is above the futures price, it's in something called backwardation, the mm-hmm. market. And that's a signal that you have a shortage, a low inventories. And by having the spot price above the forward price or futures price, what the market's trying to do is pull commodities into the near term, into inventory. They're pulling everything towards the spot market, basically, and building up inventory. So we have low inventories, and then we have a fourth thing going on. We have big structural changes as we transition our energy sectors all over the world into more green energy. So this has huge effects on green metals like lithium and silicon and nickel and anything associated with building green and replacing the old infrastructure that we have. Mm-hmm. You have a big increase for these kinds of commodities. And then, of course, the fifth thing, I'm going down, I've got five things here in the back of the wind and back of these commodities. Inflation, one. Two, coming off extremely low prices. Three, very low inventories signaled by backwardation in the markets. Four, these transition, a big structural transition into green energy. And then five, we've got the wages of war. We've got a war going on now in Ukraine. And it happens that Russia and Ukraine, to a lesser extent, produce a lot of commodities, whether it be grains like wheat, sunflower seed oil, or oil, and the metals and so forth. So all of those things combined, those five things, lead me to conclude that we have kind of a perfect cocktail for a big bull market, if not a super cycle in commodities. And so that's basically what's going on. Commodity prices are going up in this big bull market, but we also have a lot of volatility. Mm-hmm. So the two things are commodity prices going up in general a lot, really a lot, and a lot of increased volatility in these markets. So that's kind of the going back over, more than 65 years since I started trading commodities. That's the story today. Mm-hmm. It's not hedging eggs, but it's looking at all these things going up big time, mm-hmm. and being very volatile.
So is it possible that the Fed is able to kind of get control of this inflationary scenario by doing the rate hikes that they have discussed a little bit? Or would it be maybe more effective to, as you say, reduce that level of money coming out of the tap to bring that level back down in the bathtub?
Well, they're trying to, they have two instruments that they're using to try to tighten up, to slow down, to tighten up the money, the monetary stance, shall we say. Mm-hmm. The problem is, Tom, they aren't looking at the money supply. In fact, in February of last year, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, said, and I'm quoting him here, he says, "Right now, I would say growth in M2, which is quite substantial, doesn't really have important implications for the economic outlook." Well, he's essentially saying that money supply doesn't matter, and what John Greenwood and I are saying, no, that's the whole ball game. Mm-hmm. So the Fed is basically flying blind. It's like flying in an airplane without an altimeter, because the altimeter should be the money supply. They should be looking at the money supply and the altimeter. So they have the instruments. They they have the stick in their hand, and they indicate that they're going to increase the federal funds rate, but we don't know very well what the linkage is between increases in the federal funds rate and changes in the money supply. And the reason for that is that changes in the federal funds rate will affect the commercial banking system. And in fact, most of the money produced in all countries is not produced by the central bank. It's produced by the commercial banks. And so if the demand for credit is hot and the commercial banks keep increasing their contribution to the money supply, even though the Fed thinks they're tightening, they won't know if they're tightening because and they wouldn't be tightening under the scenario I just gave. If the bank contributions are going up and overwhelming the reductions in the contributions by the Federal Reserve, the total money supply will go up. So we don't know exactly what's going to happen with that instrument. And the other instrument is that they want to reduce the size of the balance sheet of the Fed. And they'll do that by letting some of the Treasury securities that they have mature. And when they mature, of course, the balance sheet shrinks because the Treasury pays the Fed at the end of the term of whatever the bond or instrument is or bill instrument that they have, and then that cash is transferred into a government account. So the balance sheet will shrink as a result of that, and that will shrink the contribution of the Federal Reserve to the money supply. But the question is, well, what's going to be happening with the rest of this that's created by the commercial banking system? And to give you an order of magnitude, in normal times, the commercial banks produce about 85 to 90% of the total money in the economy. So the elephant in the room are commercial banks, what they're doing. But so we know that the commercial banks have a tremendous amount of ammunition. They can create a lot of credit because they're awash with liquidity right now. Right now, they do what they call reverse repos. And the reverse repos, essentially, the commercial banks are doing what? They're loaning money to the Fed. Mm-hmm. They have so much liquidity that they're actually doing reverse repos and loaning money to the Fed. And the number it's about $1.7 trillion. That's about 20%. They're doing this every day, rolling these reverse repos. That's a number that's about 20% of the total size assets of the Federal Reserve. So it's a very large number. This suggests a lot of liquidity out there, a lot of ammunition. And if the demand for credit, the economy is good, business is good, demand for credit's good, the loans will be made and the contribution of the commercial banks will continue to grow. So in that case, it'll be difficult for the Fed to get that altimeter, that M2 money supply growth down to an appropriate level level off the inflation. But people don't understand what's been going on with inflation, by the way. If you read the newspapers, they're looking for inflation and the causes of inflation in all the wrong places. You're not going to read much about what I just told you about the money supply being the cause. Mm-hmm. You'll read about, Putin is creating inflation in the United States, or the supply chains. You get a string of stories about supply chain problems. That's creating. And just the weather and one thing after another. They just a million excuses. Now the reason for that, of course, is that the Federal Reserve and the central banks, They want to cover up their misdeeds. They are the source of the problem, but they don't want you to know that they're the source of the problem. They want all these so-called exogenous factors, things coming in that no one can control. The weather, the wheat prices are going up because of the weather, the war in Ukraine, and oil prices, you know, in the last 2 years, energy prices have gone up about four times. It's one of the biggest increases in energy prices since 1973, actually, since the first OPEC crisis of 1973, we've never seen oil prices go up as they've done in the last couple of years.
Well, that was actually something that I wanted to ask you about. I read that higher energy prices don't cause inflation. It just means that energy prices will rise relative to other prices. So is there a way to think about these causal relationships to frame them more clearly? It always just comes back to the money supply, right?
Yeah. The fundamental thing that sustains inflation and causes it to move one way or another is the money supply. That's the end of the story. Now, you can have short-term influences that the oil prices have gone up. So oil has gone up relative to everything else, but it does in some cases have some knock-on effect that does influence inflation. But that's kind of a secondary factor in there. If the money supply wasn't going up as it's going up now, this secondary factor thing really wouldn't work in and have much of an effect on anything. And the best way to look at that is with case studies. I mean, look at the real world, not the theory of the whole thing, but what goes on. And if you go back to the 1970s, we actually had two oil crises in the 1970s. And if you look at Japan, in the first oil crisis, the inflation rate did go up in Japan. And so everybody said, like they did every place else around the world, oh, OPEC's causing inflation. Oil prices are going up. We have inflation caused by OPEC. But if you look at the second oil crisis, which was 79-80, what happened in Japan? Well, the inflation didn't go up because the money supply was kept under control. The first time the money supply got goosed in Japan, and that accommodated this relative price change phenomenon to work its way in and give the appearance that it was causing inflation. But in the second case, the money supply was kept rather constant and at a reasonable growth rate, and you had no bump up in inflation. So that's one way to look at it. Now, the other way is to look at what's going on in the world today, and you get all these excuses or so-called causes of inflation: oil prices going up, wheat prices going up, corn prices going up. Lithium prices going to the moon, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All those things affect three countries: Japan, China, and Switzerland. And what do we have in those three countries? We have no inflation problem. I mean, you've got right now the inflation rate in Japan is 1.2% per annum. China is 1.5%, and Switzerland is 2.4%. So that's not 8.5 like you have in the United States, or in the European Union it's 7.4. Now, this suggests that those three countries have been hit with all these problems, but they have low inflation. Why? Because the money supply isn't growing very fast. So it's the money supply. It's always the money supply. There's just no way to get out of the money supply out of the picture. Mm-hmm. You do not find elevated inflation in countries that don't have an excess production or supply, if you will, of money. So it's all tangled up with the money supply.
Do you think the Fed is more scared of persistent inflation or deflation?
Right now in inflation, they're very worried about inflation. I mean, even all the doves at the Fed have become hawks in the last few weeks. So it's very interesting. And this shows you, by the way, the fact that how far off base they've gotten by not having money supply on that altimeter in the airplane they're flying at the Fed. Mm-hmm. Because if you look a year ago, they all said the inflation was temporary. Remember, Team Temporary? It was going to go away. Everything was fine. It was mm-hmm. all these temporary little shocks, supply shocks, and so it was all going to go away. And at that time, the governors of the Federal Reserve didn't anticipate any increase in the Fed funds rate. So they didn't see inflation. And they didn't expect that they would have to be increasing federal funds rate and so-called tightening the money supply. Well, all that has changed now. Now they don't exactly say inflation is endemic. They don't say that. They just say, well, this thing has gone on for longer than we thought it was. And they kind of try to brush it aside and in the meantime say, but don't worry. We've got everything under control. We're going to have a soft landing. We're going to have this inflation whipped right away. Just settle down and relax. And by the way, the markets more or less have bought into this idea that the Fed can control things rapidly and they will get things down. If you look at the forward curves in the market, they're looking at and anticipating, you know, something this for the next year, inflation to be, you know, about 3.5%. Well, it's already 8.5. That would be miraculous if they brought it down to 3.5. And if you go out beyond that, they're looking at, you know, 2.5%. Mm-hmm. The 10-year forward is, I should say the five-year is around 2.5. Mm-hmm. Inflation expectations that are priced into the market. I think they're going to be higher than that. So obviously, I think the market's mispriced and gotten it wrong.
So of course, the age-old quote of inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon is attributed to Milton Friedman, one of the people you've had the privilege of calling a mentor and a friend in your life. So how influential was he on your thinking about economics and how would you say your guys' thinking differs?
Well, he's very, number one, very influential, not only in terms of monetarism and these topics that we're talking about now, but just general economic freedom, liberty, free markets. That's my general orientation. There's some nuanced differences because on some aspects of his thinking, I'm shall we say more maybe not an Austrian economist per se in terms of a purist, but I would certainly be considered a camp follower at the least. So there are some differences in there, but it would be, you know, kind of differences that, you know, Friedrich von Hayek, a big Austrian, also a mentor and actually a family friend, Hayek, would have, you know, differences with Friedman. At one level, they were in very much agreement. But if you drill down, there are lots of differences.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, it seems that we need to be thinking about some way of creating fiscal control rules to be able to constrain the government in some way from getting this spending, you know, even more out of hand. So should we be moving towards going back to some sort of maybe a fractional gold or commodities backed standard in order to create some of these constraints?
Well, that if you had some rule that prohibited the central bank from monetizing fiscal deficits, that would be one thing. I mean, why did you go back and ask, well, why did the Fed pump up the money supply and turn on the printing presses so much after COVID? Well, that was because the fiscal authorities they spent a lot of money. And when they spent a lot of money, a big fiscal deficit arose. And about 90% of that deficit was actually monetized and bought by the Fed. I mean, the Fed was buying the treasury bills and bonds that were issued to finance the deficit that was created by the government spending. So ultimately, you go back to the fiscal authorities and by monetizing the deficit, the money supply went up, and it is always money ultimately. But what if the government was spending all that money and financed it by increasing taxes? Well, we wouldn't have inflation. The deficit would have been financed by, you know, sucking tax money out of the system. Or what if they would have sold bonds not to the Fed, but they would have sold them all to the non-bank public? Mm-hmm. They would have sucked money, you know, for you and I, Tom, would have been buying the bonds, and we wouldn't have as much disposable income left to spend because we've bought government bonds. And of course, if we did that, the interest rates on the bonds would go up, all else being equal, and that would also squeeze the economy. So we would have a little, the non-bank public under that scenario would have less disposable income at their command, and also interest rates would be higher. Mm-hmm. So that would, and inflation isn't in the picture there, by the way. Mm-hmm. But that's not how it was financed. It was financed by the Federal Reserve monetizing about 90% of it. Mm-hmm. And that's what's been going on all around the world. People say, oh, we have this global inflation problem. No, we don't have a global inflation problem. We have central banks in individual countries doing essentially the same thing the Fed was doing, financing and monetizing a lot of fiscal deficits, increasing the money supply very rapidly, and we've ended up with inflation. And what happens, by the way, the sequence is important. And the sequence is that once the money supply goes up, once that money goes in the bathtub, the first thing that happens is asset prices go up with a lag of about 1 to 9 months. And of course, what happened? Asset prices did. Homes went up. The stock market boomed. All those asset prices. Then the next thing, with a lag of about 6 to 18 months, the real economy kicks in. And of course, the economy is very hot. And then with the final step, with a lag of about 12 to 24 months, is that inflation picks up. So, and that's the overflow valve activity. Mm-hmm. Going on. So we've had exactly that sequence in this COVID period all over the world, except China, Japan, and Switzerland. We haven't seen this kind of big increase in the money supply, ultimately going through to asset prices going up, real economy getting very hot, and inflation picking up. Mm-hmm. So, and then, of course, every place has had these supply chain shocks, the oil price going up and distortions in the economy. And to some extent, where the money supply has been elevated, those price increases have had some effect on the overall inflation picture.
Do you think it's a reasonable point of view to say that that gold maybe front ran or sensed and reacted to the coming inflation that we've seen when we saw the price of gold move up dramatically from 2018 to 2020?
Well, I mean, it did come before the, so you can say maybe the gold bugs knew what was coming down the pike. Who knows? I think that's a little bit of a stretch. I mean, those prices did occur. I have been, for quite some time, I mean, structurally kind of bullish on gold. But it wasn't the idea that somehow the inflation was, the COVID was going to come and there'd be a huge fiscal and monetary stimulus and we'd have inflation as a result of that. I think the inflation story is part of the gold story, but I think the gold story now is one of the more important thing to watch is what's going on with, especially after this, the war began, is what central banks are going to be doing. And I think it's just a structural bull market because central banks are buying. And for example, if you look at what's going on in Russia, the Russian ruble is essentially pegged to gold, and at 155,500 rubles per ounce, that's the peg, and this essentially puts, if you work out all the arithmetic, it essentially puts a floor under the ruble dollar exchange rate of about 80 rubles to the dollar. That would be the floor. It's now stronger than that. It's about 72 rubles, but that's why the ruble rallied back, because they've attached it to gold, and also it puts a kind of an implied floor, again abstracting from transactions cost and this kind of thing, mm-hmm. of let's say around 1940, $1,940 an ounce on a gold. So today, of course, gold's been moving around big time, but the right now, the Russians at that rate and the ruble exchange rate would be buyers of gold. They'd be buying gold, so they're buying right now. Mm-hmm. The arbitrage is to the ruble. You can do better selling to the Central Bank of Russia for 155,000 rubles, 155,500 rubles than you could out in the market. Mm-hmm. So they're taking in gold now. They're accumulating right now. Given all the prices going on, they've been shifting around. This is May 2nd. We're recording this, and gold's been all over the place today. Mm-hmm.
But I've read that window is only open to domestic gold producers within Russia. So does that, you know, kind of really put a hamper on that arbitrage opportunity?
Well, that's why I say this is abstracting from transactions cost and everything else. But don't worry, gold will find its way to Moscow from Dubai and Istanbul, and
that's a great point.
Arbitrage is a little like a magnet, and you know, if it gets wide enough, the strength of the magnet gets stronger and stronger, and gold moves around. It finds it goes to the magnet.
Mm-hmm.
So structurally, I think, given what's happened since the war broke out and the weaponizing of the U.S. dollar in particular, gold as a currency that's not the liability of any sovereign, that isn't connected in any way with the sovereign, has some a certain attractiveness from that point of view. And so I think you know, you'll see central banks buying. So that's kind of the overall fundamental picture. But remember, I said that volatility is very important in these commodity markets, and volatility, to track that, you've really got to be start thinking about the sentiment in the market. Mm-hmm. You've got to figure out what the sentiment is. It bullish or is it bearish? Mm-hmm. And that's changing around all the time.
Absolutely. You know, that's an excellent point that I know a lot of gold bugs are thinking about right now, is the amount of volatility that we've seen. And of course, you are the co-creator of the Hanke Koufness Gold Sentiment Index. So is this one of, you know, you just mentioned the importance of gold to central banks. Is that one of the reasons that you thought that this was an important tool for you to have created?
Well, the reason that we created the tool with Abe Koufness, who I've worked with for many years, because actually Abe was one of my students many moons ago at the University of California, Berkeley, in the early 70s. So let's talk about sentiment. Now, sentiment, it's very important in the economy and markets, and it's something that practical people always pay the closest and most anxious attention to. And when we say sentiment, well, everyone has sentiment. Everyone just thinks about, well, are things good? Are things bad? Bullish? Bearish? What in the economy? In my business? And they're always making decisions. But you get, so there's kind of an intuitive feel about sentiment. Everyone has it. Anyone, you could walk down the street and ask anyone. And ask them if, you know, things looking good, things looking bad. They would give you some idea. But the question is, well, are there any ways to measure it?
Sorry, Steve, just to interrupt you for a second.
Yeah.
Would it be fair to say that sentiment is really one of the main drivers of these markets?
In the short term, yes. Mm-hmm. The first thing we were talking about is more like fundamentals. Mm-hmm. So you have fundamental analysis that, you know, let's put it this way. It's a supply and demand curve kind of thing, the fundamentals. Mm-hmm. But the sentiment is dealing with this volatility. Are things changing around? Bullish, bearish, bullish, good, bad. You know, how's the weather today? Is it going to rain out there and be bad, or is the sun out? Is it good? The weather is changing every day, but the fundamental factors are moving along at a much slower pace. So if we talk about measuring it, now for the economy at large, we have things like the Consumer Confidence Index, which has been around for a long, long time. So we have lots of measures for the economy like that. And if you look at markets, then the technical analysts have a variety of things that they measure to indicate bullish or bearish sentiment in the markets. Now, what Abe Koufness and I have done, we've moved the next step, and I think the first step into measuring bullish and bearish sentiment, in this case, in the gold market. We started in the gold market because it's international, it's deep, everyone's, you know, every country is involved in the thing. So it's kind of a global thing. And our measurement is based on what I would call reading the text of articles that are coming out on an hourly basis about gold. Mm-hmm. And when I say reading the text, we have a computer algorithm developed. And this computer algorithm does the reading. Koufness and I aren't sitting there reading hundreds of articles every hour, 24 hours a day. The computer is doing that. But we have a dictionary of bullish and bearish words that, of course, we've developed, and that is proprietary. Mm-hmm. But the computer reads the text. This is called text mining, is what they call this. And the article comes out, we read it, and then is the article bullish or is the article bearish? And from that aggregation of articles every hour, we get a sentiment score, either a bullish or bearish sentiment score. And then from that, you can devise, and we're devising, trading signals. And what we found is that when you get extreme readings, either extreme bullish, it is a signal to do what? Not to buy, to sell. Because if you get an extreme bullish reading, you know you'll revert back to a more neutral or bearish position. The thing will turn on you. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of the kind of signal. This morning we had a signal, by the way, early in the morning, about 5 a.m. Eastern time, and it was extreme bullish signal, and so we sold. We automatically sold. And then that reading was on a scale of 0 to 10, actually minus 10 to plus 10. It was 8.4. So it was extreme bullish. We sold and very rapidly, this is a for quite a rapid change. It swung around to minus around 5. I can't remember the exact number right now. Mm-hmm. And we switched our position. We liquidated the short and went long. And at a profit, by the way. But so the sentiment can move very, very, very rapidly. So and sometimes it can move very slowly, but we are able to measure, and we're pretty confident now that we have a good measure for sentiment in the gold market based off not technical analysis, not survey research or anything like this, but hourly readings of what's coming out in the press on the gold market. And we've developed this in such a way, Tom, that we now have a standard free membership, and anyone, you can get the sentiment score once a day, or you can have what we call a gold package for $15 a month, and you get a 5 recordings or measurements each day, and also some signals and alerts if we have one of these turning points like today. You would have 2 special signals today. One early in the morning, about 5 a.m., and one about 9 a.m. Mm-hmm. Sell at 5 a.m., reverse a position at about 9. Mm-hmm. So you get those things. And the 5 scores that we send out, we have one for the Australian Open of the gold market, then the Dubai Open, then the London Open, the U.S. Open, and the U.S. Close. And you, the people can get into this by going to our website, go to the goldsentimentreport.com, all one word, goldsentimentreport.com. And you will be able to sign up free, or if you want the monthly package for $15. And I told you before, we back tested this. We're trading now with real money, but we have back tested the thing back to June, and it's done rather well. I mean, on the back test, it's using these signals we've devised. It's up close to 80%.
So, Steve, does the, let's say, the time scale that it is measuring, in some ways change over time or change basically day by day so that it's dynamic and that is what helps it succeed?
No, it's just measuring every hour. Mm-hmm. So the time dimension remains the same. What changes is the sentiment.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And as you could see, today happened to be a very narrow window. Mm-hmm. We got two signals within about, you know, the space of about 4 hours or 4 or 5 hours. That's a very narrow window. Usually it's drawn out in a much longer duration than today. It happens today was one of the shortest ones. I don't know. I'd have to look at the records, but it's a very short window. Mm-hmm.
So you're really just trading the volatility within the kind of the longer term bullish forecast that you were talking about earlier, right?
Right, right. The sentiment has nothing to do with the fundamentals or the bullish, bearish, long-term point of view. Mm-hmm. It's really the durations are short, and it's the frequency of changing the bullish or bearish perspective is much, much shorter than, I mean, I've had a bullish perspective on fundamentals for years. Mm-hmm. So the fundamentals don't change they're really slow motion kind of things. But the sentiment thing is important because let's say, okay, I happen to be a long-term bull. And I want to optimize the size of my position. So I'm either, maybe I want to subtract a little or add a little. The sentiment signal will tell me when that's a good time. So I don't get in there and do it just the wrong time. Mm-hmm. So it's either for trading, like I said today, We sold and covered a position, and we were short and long within about a 5 hour span. Mm-hmm. But if you want to optimize a portfolio and be fine around, that's another way to use sentiment. So you don't get in or get out at the wrong time, basically. Mm-hmm. But your fundamental view doesn't change. I mean, you.
They're two very separate things, right?
Yeah, two completely separate things.
Mm-hmm. So, Steve,
with a sentiment, by the way, we will work eventually, Tom. We have not done this yet because we like to slowly do research and slowly get into things and step by step, and it's conceivable that if you had long run averages, this is just a conjecture. I'm not saying this is the case. Mm-hmm. It's conceivable that you could stretch this sentiment thing and sentiment score out, you know, have a moving average that would stretch the duration out. I mean, we do run longer moving averages, but it's conceivable that we'll be able to work out signals for a longer term, a longer duration than those that we've been talking about right now. Because right now it's just hour by hour. And whenever you're going to an extreme bullish position, you want to get out of your long position and go short and vice versa. If you get to an extreme bearish position, you want to get out of your short position and go on. Mm-hmm.
So, Steve, I've heard you say that simplicity is one of the keys to how you're able to think about such complex problems. So can you explain this more to us as we're just inundated with so much information in today's day and age?
Well, I think one thing that you have to remember is that my 95% rule, Tom, is that 95% of what you read in the financial press is either wrong or irrelevant. So if you're just soaking it all in, you just have a barrage of stuff coming at you, but you have to have some framework to think about things. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have that, that's the simplicity. You have to have obviously a model that you validated that works. But the key thing is to have a model so you're not. It's like a machine gun coming at you with all the news and everything. Mm-hmm. If you have a model like we do, for example, measuring sentiment, we measure it every hour. I can tell you, are the articles that are out there at the end of this hour on gold, are they bullish or are they bearish? Mm-hmm. And we do that. The model is, what's the model? Well, the algorithm is the algorithm, and the secret sauce, of course, is the dictionary of bullish and bearish words that influence the gold market. So that would be the sentiment thing. Going to other things, you're talking about really always with commodities. It's supply, demand in the spot market and inventories. So those are kind of the stuff that's pretty simple when you think about it. Mm-hmm. I want to know what's the inventory of wheat? What's the supply and demand forecast look like? And then you can be looking at other things going on. Now, what moves the market around and changes the sentiment in the wheat market? You're looking at the weather or the fundamentals. You're looking now, we've got big fertilizer shortages. So if you don't have fertilizer, you know, the yields are going to be lower than would otherwise be the case. So what does that do? That means a supply. You're looking at supply.
Excellent, Steve. Well, I really appreciate you sharing all of your perspective and your knowledge with us today. Is there anything else you'd like to touch on before we wrap up here?
I don't think there's anything. I think we've pretty much covered the waterfront. We can have session two and go into other things when that time arises, we will.
Absolutely. I look forward to that. There's so much of your knowledge base here that we haven't explored, and so much of it that I think our listeners would appreciate getting your perspective on.
One last thing. Mm-hmm. Just get my oar in again on this. The listeners should go to the goldsentimentreport.com and they'll find out about what we've been talking about with the gold sentiment. And if they want a free subscription, they get one with a gold sentiment score once a day. And if they want to ramp up to 5 scores a day and special reports and so forth, they've got a $15 a month fee for that.
Excellent. And of course, that's available at thegoldsentimentreport.com. Professor Hanke, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be with you. Thank you so much.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.